It was a town still devastated that greeted John Ward 2 days later. Walking cousin slowly up to the charred ruins of Douglas Fandon's store, John could only assume that the wreckage was most likely associated with the man he trailed. There was a man standing in the middle of what apparently was once a store, pulling splintered timbers aside and poking under piles of debris. John stepped down from the buckskin.
If you were looking to buy supplies, I'm afraid you're a little late.
I expect I might be looking for the man who did this. At least that would be my guess.
Who might you be?
John Ward.
Fannin dropped the smutty timber he was holding and walked out of the wreckage.
Are you a lawman?
Yes, sir. From Fort Smith.
Fort Smith? Arkansas? Do you know you're in Kansas territory?
I reckon. I've been trailing an outlaw from south of here in the Nations. A half-breed. His name's Boot Stoner. Has a young girl with him. And I'm betting this is some of his work.
I wish to hell you'd been here 2 days ago.
Yes, sir. I wish I had, too.
It was the man you're after, all right. Half-breed, had an Indian girl with him. Couldn't have been anybody but him. Said he wanted to trade. Then after he looked around in the store, he said there wasn't anything he wanted and left. It was him, all right. We thought at first he got blown up with the building. There were pieces of some poor soul scattered about the place. Turned out it wasn't him, though. We found a belt buckle like one my hired man wore. It was driven halfway into solid timber, and he hasn't been seen since. His name was Ed Swadley. We buried as much of him as could be found. What I can't figure out is how he happened to be in the store. Maybe poor Ed stumbled on him robbing the place and tried to stop him. I reckon I can build the store again. I was planning to tear it down sometime anyway and build a bigger one. Why in God's name did he blow the damn place up? Why didn't he just take what he wanted and leave?
Hard to say. Seems he's carrying a powerful hatred for just about the whole world.
Looping the buckskin's range over the hitching post, the only thing left standing after Boot's departure, John started looking around the area for tracks that might tell him where the renegade had headed. Fannin resumed his search through the ruins of his store. It took some time and careful examination of the ground because of the multitude of tracks left by the town's curious after the explosion, but he finally settled upon a trail left by two horses leaving the back of the store. They led off to the east and were a day or two older than most of the other tracks. He returned to the hitching post and stepped up into the saddle. John rode out of Oswego. About a mile out of town, he came to a creek. Close to the bank, in a wide patch of switchgrass, he discovered multiple tracks and droppings that told him Boot had left the two mules there while he raided Fannin's store. Certain now that he was on the proper trail, he nudged Cousin for a little increase in speed. Crossing the creek, he followed the tracks east toward the Missouri. The cash in Boot Stoner's pocket was beginning to burn against his thigh, and he was itching to spend some of it on some strong spirits and maybe a little gambling. His last drink had been with Billy Sorefoot, and there was no whiskey among the goods he had taken from Fannin's store. After rounding a bend in the river to discover a cluster of shacks and what happened to be a mining camp, he halted the horses. Looking the assembly of structures over, he determined all but one were living quarters for the miners. The one remaining was built larger and a bit more substantially. Boot was certain it must be a saloon.
I need me a drink.
He prodded his horse toward the building in the center of the settlement. He tied the horses at the rail and headed inside. The fumes that greeted his nose told him that he was in the right place. He stood in the doorway for a moment, looking the room over while he waited for Lily to catch up. Two men sat at one of the tables, playing two-handed poker. They both looked toward the door when Boot entered, followed by Lily. A third man got up from a chair at the end of the bar and shuffled casually over behind it.
That there gal looks Injun to me, and I can't sell no liquor to no Injun.
I didn't hear nobody say she wanted liquor.
You know, you don't look exactly all white to me either.
Boot's eyes narrowed in a deadly frown. He brought his rifle up level with the bar.
This Winchester says I'm white enough.
Whoa, mister!
He slapped some hard cash on the bar.
Now suppose you pour me a drink.
Sure, you can have a drink. No hard feelings.
One of the men playing poker rose from his chair and approached the bar.
I'm Reese Freeman. Don't pay no mind to Barney there. He don't mean no harm. I don't believe I've seen you around here before.
He cocked his head at the bartender.
That sure is a hell of a way to welcome a stranger, Barney. Why don't you come on over and sit down with Jake and me, and I'll buy you another drink. Well, me and Jake was just playing a little poker to pass the time. Maybe you care to play a few hands? Just friendly stakes, you understand?
Yeah, I'll play some poker.
As could be expected, Boots' luck was strong in the beginning, and he won four of the first five hands. There was a great deal of friendly banter while the cards were dealt, all of it generated by Reese and bouncing off of a stoic Boots Stoner. The whiskey glasses were never allowed to go dry, and Barney brought a fresh bottle to the table before nonchalantly slipping out the side door. A few minutes later, the flame in the lamp on the end of the bar flickered slightly from the draft when Barney opened the door, followed in by a buxom lady wearing a long kimono, the top of which was unbuttoned almost to her navel. She sashayed casually over to stand behind Boot. Boot paused to look the woman over, then returned his attention to the card game. It struck him that he was the only one playing with coins, while Rafe and Reese bet with paper.
This place looks like a mining camp to me. Ain't you got any hard money?
It is a mining camp, but there ain't no gold. It's a lead mine. You wouldn't think too kindly of us if we was to bet with lead dollars.
The woman placed a hand on Boot's shoulder.
Hey, darling. My name's Rose. You might want to spend some of that money to have a little fun.
I might, when I get done here.
Rose bent low over him, causing her gown to gap even more, and placed a hand on his thigh.
I can guarantee you a good time.
I bet you could.
Boot rested a hand on her generous backside. She gave him a playful slap on the hand.
Naughty, naughty. No free samples.
There was a converse reaction from the spectator on the stool in the corner. When she witnessed Rose's advances upon Boot, and Boot's obviously welcome reception, a hailstorm of confusing and conflicting thoughts went racing through Lily's mind. She had been long battered and abused by the cruel half-breed, and her young brain had been sufficiently broken that she could no longer remember what life was like before becoming Boot Stoner's property. Confronted with the seductive performance of the saucy but overripe saloon whore, she momentarily lost all sense of reality, seeing it as a direct threat to her rightful position. A rational person would find it difficult to explain what took place next. Still taunting playfully, Rose took a step back toward Boot and puckered her full painted lips as if to tempt him with a kiss. Boot started to grab her again, but before he could raise a hand, Rose's head was suddenly jerked back. Flat on the floor now, Lily was upon Rose like a wildcat defending her young. Without a word, Boot got up from his chair and knocked Lily across the room. Following the stunned Creek girl, when she tried to scramble to her feet, he struck her again.
That goddamn Indian bitch!
Seeing Lily totally subdued, Rose thought to extract further retribution from the now defenseless girl. All eyes were on the half-breed as he stood glaring back at them, his rifle in both his hands now. Reese sought to ease the tension.
Whoa! Nothing but a little horrified. Let's have a little drink and get back to the card game.
I'm done playing cards.
With one hand, he reached down and dragged Lily to her feet.
Don't let this little scuffle rile you. Hell, we was just getting started good, and you're riding a pretty good lucky streak.
I said I'm done playing cards. Lily, take that money off the table.
Jake rose to his feet.
Now, wait a minute, friend. You can't quit while you're way ahead without giving us a chance to get even. That money stays on the table. We ain't gonna let you walk out of here with all that money.
Seeing the way things were going, Rose made a sensible decision and slipped out the side door to the spare room. Lily quickly swept the money from the table into her skirt and hurried out the door.
You drank up a hell of a lot of whiskey that ain't been paid for.
I put two $10 gold pieces on the bar when I came in. That'll take care of any liquor I drunk. I'm leaving now, so I expect all three of you best get over in that corner so as I can keep an eye on you.
Inside the spare room, Rose inspected the damage done to her hair and face.
Woo! That bitch!
Forgetting the sensible decision she'd made in retreating, she became more and more angry as she stared into the mirror. She stalked back to the door and pressed her ear against the crack to listen.
I'm leaving now, so I expect all three of you best get over in that corner so as I can keep an eye on you.
Her gaze fell upon the shotgun Barney kept propped against the wall beside her, and she decided to take matters into her own hands. On the other side of the door, Boot continued to step backward toward the front door, keeping his eye riveted on the three watching anxiously from the corner. He had just moved past the side door. When it opened, Boot wheeled around.
Who wants to go next?
Once outside the saloon, he wasted no time in making a hasty getaway. Lily was seated in the saddle of her horse, holding his reins. They galloped away, weaving their way through the assembly of shacks and tents of the miners. Following the river, Boot drove the horses hard until they came to a shallow ford. Crossing over then, he drove them on until he was forced to let them rest. Selecting a copse of poplars and oaks, he led the horses in among the trees and dismounted. There had been no sign of anyone chasing them, even though they had been slowed considerably by the pack mules. So much so that Boot decided he was tired of bothering with them.
Ain't nobody chasing us. Make me some coffee. After that, you can go through them packs and get out anything you need for cooking. I'm cutting the mules loose. I'm tired of fooling with them.
Lily proceeded to go through the mechanical movements required to gather wood, build a fire, and boil a pot of coffee for him. But her mind was elsewhere, hovering between the reality of her present state and that of a mere few weeks past. What had happened to her that had caused her to attack the woman in the saloon in what could only be described as a jealous rage? She had actually fought to defend her claim as victim of a man who had savagely beaten and raped her. Now that fact came down hard enough on her to cause her to question her sanity, and she was suddenly shocked with the reality of her situation. She could no longer surrender to her status as a piece of property. The incident in the saloon made her realize how debased she had become and how hopeless her future would be. It would be better to be dead. Her decision was made at that moment to attempt an escape, no matter the cost. After resting the horses, Boot took the bridles off the mules and set them free. In the saddle again, he led out toward the south, planning to cut back to the west before reaching the Boston Mountains. Lily followed dutifully. Looking back over her shoulder, she could see the mules tagging along behind them. Boot figured that his greatest safety would lie in Indian territory, where, except for the rare individual like John Ward, lawmen hesitated to venture. Before he went to prison, there were several spots along the Cimarron that served as outlaw havens. Perhaps they were still in existence. They made another 5 miles before approaching darkness and dictated the need to select a campsite. In a country of gently rolling hills, there were many likely spots to choose from. Boot picked one by a narrow stream. When he was through with her for the night, following her usual practice, Lily went to the stream to cleanse herself. Lily realized what had made the sounds. The mules had continued to follow along behind them. She looked back at the sleeping man by the fire to see if he had heard. Moving about as quietly as she could manage, she saddled her horse and packed a few things she felt she needed, all the while watching Boot for any signs of waking. She took the risk of tiptoeing back to his blanket to lift his pistol from the holster. If she was discovered trying to escape, she vowed to defend herself. Bending over the sleeping man with the pistol in her hand, she hesitated for a brief moment. The temptation to kill him was strong, but her fear of the man was such that she could not pull the trigger. What if the gun misfired? What if there was no bullet in the chamber, and he was awakened by the click of the hammer on an empty cylinder? She had witnessed his rattlesnake quick reactions. He would be on her in a split second. Rather than risk failure in the deed, she resigned herself to simply fleeing and hoping that he would lose interest in following her after a while. When all was ready, she led her horse quietly out of the camp, across the stream, and into the hardwoods along the bank. In an attempt to slow his pursuit, she had taken Boots' bridle with her and threw it into some brush about 50 yards away from the camp. She climbed up in the saddle and pointed her horse toward the dark silhouette of the mountains to the south. Her thought was to first attempt to lose him in the mountains. After that, the only place she knew where she might be safe was with her people in Lohawk. It would be a long journey, but there was nowhere else a young Creek girl could go, especially one who had been ruined. A day and a half after leaving Douglas Fannin's store in Oswego, John came to the mining settlement proclaiming itself to be Joplin. As he walked Cousin slowly through the camp, he was conscious of the stares of the occasional miner, receiving a nod from one or two as they looked upon another suspicious stranger. Had he known the circumstances that prompted the cool reception, he would have understood the absence of a friendly greeting. The trail so easily followed from Oswego was now obliterated among the many tracks in the mining camp, so he guided Cousin toward the one larger structure near the center of the community. Dropping Cousin's reins loosely across the hitching post, he stepped up on the low stoop and went inside. He made out the form of the bartender sitting in a chair at the far end of the bar. There was no one else in the room.
What'll it be, mister?
I reckon I could use a glass of beer.
We're getting to be a regular tourist stop. You're the second stranger we've had in 2 days. Make that three if you count the engine girl.
Is that a fact? Just so happens I'm looking for a man with an Indian girl.
I hope to hell they ain't friends of yours.
Hardly.
Good. Because you're too damn big to throw out of here.
This man, was he a half-breed? Name of Boots Stoner?
That's the one, all right. As mean a son of a bitch as I've ever seen. He hit this place hard, I'm telling you.
What happened here?
He shot a whore, he did. The only whore in this camp. Why are you looking for him? Are you a lawman?
I'm a deputy marshal out of Fort Smith. He's left a string of murders across Oklahoma and Kansas, as well as one family in Arkansas.
Saints preserve us. I reckon we was lucky he didn't shoot nobody but Rose.
Don't sound like Rose was too lucky. Don't you have any law in these parts?
No, we sent for the sheriff over in town. That's about a mile away. He came over and stood around a little while before he said the half-breed was too long gone. There wasn't much he could do about it.
How long has Stoner been gone?
Since last evening.
Do you know which way he headed?
Sure. He took off through the south part of the camp. If we go outside, I can show you exactly.
Much obliged.
John was anxious to pick up Stoner's trail, knowing now that he was less than a full day behind. It took some time, however, to pick out the tracks he searched for among the many around the camp. Before he could distinguish the mule prints from the horses, making the trail easier to follow. Unfortunately, there were as many mule tracks around the mining camp as horses, maybe more. Consequently, he followed a couple of false trails before settling on the one he felt certain was that of Boots Stoner, the girl, Lily, and their two pack mules. He had closed the gap between himself and the bloodthirsty outlaw. Of that he was certain, but there was still a lot of ground to make up. Boots Stoner woke up hungry and chilly. The fire had died out to nothing more than a few live coals. His immediate reaction was anger. He rolled over on his side, intending to give the slumbering Creek girl a kick. Lily wasn't there. He assumed that she had retreated into the bushes to relieve herself.
Lily! Get your lazy ass back here and make me some coffee!
He expected an immediate rustle of bushes signaling the girl's response to his command.
Ah, God damn it.
Throwing his blanket aside, he stormed up from his bed with the intention of administering the punishment she deserved.
Lily!
Still, there was no answer. After a few moments more of silence, the fact that she might have fled occurred to him. Beyond anger, he stamped about in the brush searching, knowing, as each second passed, that the girl was not there. She was gone. The thought infuriated him so that her recapture dominated all other thoughts. Then another thought occurred that caused him to panic.
The horses!
He turned around and ran back to the stream where the horses were hobbled. Much to his immediate relief, his horse was still grazing near the water's edge. Across the stream, the two mules were contentedly munching on fresh shoots of spring grass. But Lily's horse was gone. Foregoing breakfast, he rolled up his blanket and picked up his saddle, furious in his eagerness to pick up Lily's trail. Then he reached up to take the horse by the bridle.
What?
He was confused at first, for although the horses were hobbled, he had left the bridles on.
That creek bitch took it. She's as good as dead.
He took a length of rope and fashioned an Indian bridle with two half hitches in the middle, looped it around the horse's lower jaw, then threw his saddle on and mounted up. Boot kicked the horse in the flanks and jerked on the rope reins. Crossing the stream some 50 yards south of the camp, he failed to spot the bridle hanging from the lower branch of a sweet gum tree. As before, the mules tagged along behind. Neither mule was hit when Boot fired, but they wisely dropped back, deeming it sensible to trail the irate man from a greater distance. Rugged and foreboding, the Boston Mountains loomed up before the desperate Indian girl. A land of steep slopes and deep river valleys, rocky cliffs, and forests thick with red oak and hickory, as well as the ever-present pine. Her mountains were the highest of the Ozark Plateau. Birthplace of the White and Buffalo Rivers, the harsh area had served as hideout for more than one gang of bushwhackers and rebel guerrilla bands during the war between the states. Nearing exhaustion, Lily pushed her weary horse onward. She would not permit the horse to rest until she was safely into the slopes at the base of the mountains. Riding without pause through the night, and now until dusk of the following day, she, like her mount, was in dire need of food, water, and rest. On foot now, she led the drained animal up into a ravine, where a trickle of water from an underground spring bubbled up between the roots of a large oak tree. This would have to do until her horse had rested enough to carry her higher up into the mountains. Using her knife, she carved a hole in the earth around the roots of the oak to form a small basin for her horse to drink. Unable to keep her mind from the image of the cruel face of Boot Stoner, she could not resist the constant urge to look over her shoulder, expecting the savage half-breed to suddenly appear. Although her rational mind told her that it was unlikely, if not impossible, for Boot to have caught up to her, she feared he was possessed of such evil medicine that he could summon dark spirits to help him. With thoughts like these to haunt her, she resolved to move farther into the mountains as soon as her horse was rested. As for herself, she would remain vigilant, reserving her time to rest until after she'd found a place she felt was safe. She knew he was set upon returning to the nations, and when she first fled from her captor, she had hoped that he would not feel it worth his time to follow her. Deep inside, however, she feared he would come after her, if only to kill her. Not willing to risk a fire for fear the smoke might be spotted, she made a meal of some dried meat taken from Fannin's store. There seemed to be an abundance of small game in the hills about her, so she was confident she'd be able to find food once she found a safe place to hide. She had her flint and steel to make a fire, and she could fashion a snare from the short length of rope on her saddle. Fighting the almost overpowering urge to close her eyes for a few minutes' rest, she ate her beef strips while constantly watching her back trail. After riding for approximately 2 hours, she found that the valley broadened into a wide meadow, leading up to a river that flowed through the mountains. The other side of the river was bordered by lofty cliffs of limestone that reached straight up for hundreds of feet. She followed a creek back into the hardwood forest for several hundred feet before selecting her campsite. After hobbling the horse by the creek, she gathered enough dead limbs to build a small fire. Finally, too weary to worry about Boot Stoner for the moment, she finished the rest of the dried beef and was sound asleep within seconds. Burly Chase sat down and slid to the bottom of the steep slope on his behind. All the while, his eyes searched the faint trail that had led him down the mountainside to the creek. She was a fine-looking doe. Burly had spotted the four deer when they began to move just after first light. He hadn't approached quietly enough, so they scattered when they heard him in the trees above them. He wasn't particularly proud of that, but he had his mind set on venison, so he gave chase. Forgetting the others, Burly went after the doe.
Well, I'm getting too damn old to run a damn deer down.
He crept along the creek bank.
I know you're in here, darling. I can feel you.
Carefully placing one foot at a time, he inched his way closer to a thicket of laurel. Suddenly, he saw a slight movement of the branches on the other side of the creek. Instantly, he dropped to one knee, thinking he had stumbled upon one of the other deer, for he was certain the doe had not crossed over. Peering intently at the thicket, he decided to forget the doe and take the closer shot. There was just a brief glimpse of brown hide showing through the leaves, and he figured the shot would not be there for long. He raised his carbine and sighted on the target.
Oh, I wish I could see a little more of the damn things, so I'd know whether I'm shooting the ass end or the head.
As his finger poised to squeeze the trigger, the bushes parted a little and a head pushed through. But instead of a deer, it was a horse's head. Burley froze, afraid to move. Startled to find a horse in this part of the mountains, his initial thought was that it was ridden by a lawman, possibly looking for him. After a few moments stalled by indecision, he deemed it in his best interest to immediately withdraw. Stepping carefully and quietly, skills acquired out of necessity to survive in this mountain wilderness, he made his way back up through the hardwood forest to a sandstone ledge from which he could watch the creek below him. It had been years since he had taken refuge in these mountains, and Burley had lost count of the seasons that had passed. The rest of his gang of bushwhackers had long since returned to their homes after the war, seeking amnesty, or had moved west. A few had been caught by the Federals while trying to buy supplies in the settlements. Burley had chosen to live off the land. He was an outlaw. Of that, there was no denial. But he had not started out that way. Joining a group of guerrillas led by Jack Wheeler, Burley, like most of the others, had sought to punish the Yankee troops who invaded his homeland. As the war wound down, however, the gang turned toward attacks on civilian targets with no military significance. It had become a matter of survival, and the raids became more and more justifiable in their minds. Before they were finally dispersed, Bloody Jack Wheeler's name became synonymous with Bushwhacker and was despised by Reb and Yankee alike. 2 months after Lee's surrender, Bloody Jack was shot in the head by a farmer who caught him in his barn stealing chickens. It was a somewhat less than glorious demise for a group of men claiming to proudly fight for the Confederacy. Burley figured his family and friends had long since given him up for dead, and that was the way he wanted it. Fearing a prison cell, he preferred to live out his years here in the mountains. This intruder today was not the first to venture into this wilderness. There had been others, hunters and trappers, most just passing through. Burley had managed to stay out of sight until they had gone, and none had stumbled upon his cave under the waterfall. But he had almost blundered into this situation today, and at this point, he didn't know if it was one man or a posse, so he waited and watched. A few minutes later, a person appeared briefly by the creek bank.
Well, I'll be.
It looked like a woman. Moments later, he changed his mind.
A girl. An Indian girl.
Peering as hard as he could in an effort to see through the trees, he looked for her companion. Surely she was not alone up here in the mountains. Try as he might, however, he couldn't see anyone else. Deciding that even if there was someone with her, they didn't pose any threat to him, he determined to take a closer look. Backing down from the ledge, he worked his way across the slope until he found a place where he could get a broader look at the creek bank. Parting the juniper leaves before him, he peered through to discover a scene he found most surprising. There was no one with her, just one young girl and one horse, and she looked to be trying to rig a snare by the creek bank.
I'm damned if I know what she thinks she'll catch with that. Well, ain't none of my affair.
He prepared to retreat to his cave, the deer hunt having been effectively canceled for the morning. He picked up his carbine and took a step backward, preparing to leave, but something about the girl made him hesitate.
Now, what in the world is an Indian girl doing here in the Boston Mountains by herself, this far from the nations?
She looked to be about the age of his daughter when he had left wife and family to join Bloody Jack Wheeler. That thought proceeded to tug at his conscience a bit as he watched Lily's wasted efforts with her snare. Annie, his daughter, used to catch rabbits with a snare. He had a sudden attack of melancholy when he thought about how long it had been since he had seen her.
Ah, damned old fool. I'm probably gonna regret this.
He started to make his way down toward the creek. Lily withdrew to a position a few yards away from the rope snare she had fashioned. There were squirrels skittering among the trees above her head, but none seemed the slightest bit interested in the scraps of dried beef in the rope circle on the ground. She knew the rope was really too big and clumsy, and she needed better bait, but the beef was all she had, and she was depriving an already empty stomach of that in the desperate hope that a curious squirrel would investigate.
You won't likely catch no squirrel with that thing. And there ain't no rabbits up this high that I've ever seen.
In a panic, Lily almost stumbled and fell as she ran to her horse and fumbled in her saddlebag for the pistol she had taken from Boot. Figuring on the possibility of that reaction from the startled girl, Burley moved a few yards over to a clump of laurel surrounding a stout hickory trunk. He watched carefully as Lily, her hands trembling with fear, took cover behind her horse, aiming the pistol at the bushes from which his voice had come.
Little lady?
The frightened girl whirled around and pointed her pistol at a different clump of laurel.
I don't mean you no harm. You ain't got nothing to fear from old Burley. Say, you speak American?
I've got a gun. What do you want?
Me? I don't want nothing. Looks to me like you're the one needing help.
There was a momentary standoff with neither party knowing what to say. Burley almost wished that he hadn't decided to speak to her, but he made another attempt.
Are you lost? 'Cause you look lost to me.
No, I'm not lost.
Well, this ain't the road to nowhere. Where are you headed?
Lohawk?
Lohawk? You mean Lohawk over in the Creek Nation? Well, this sure ain't the blame road to Lohawk. Well, listen, I'm coming out and we'll talk. I ain't gonna do you no harm. You can hold on to your pistol if it'll make you feel better, but don't go pointing the blame thing at me. All right? All right, now, I'm coming out.
Remaining behind her horse for protection, Lily jerked the pistol around to aim at a sudden parting in a clump of laurel ringing a large hickory tree. Out in the open stepped a short gnome of a man no taller than Lily herself. With a protruding stomach paunch, he was almost as big around as he was tall. With a face flushed red from years of cold wind and hot sun, and partially covered with dirty gray whiskers, he presented a picture that was far from menacing. Lily let the pistol drop to her side. Dressed head to toe in animal skins, the workmanship decrying expertise with a sewing needle, Burley Chase stepped into Lily's life.
Yeah. Burley Chase is my name.
Lily.
You say you're going to Lohawk? Well, how on God's green earth did you wind up here in the mountains? Lohawk's over 100 miles from here, yonder way. Where'd you start out from?
Lily turned and pointed north. No longer feeling a need to protect herself from this comical figure of a man, she stuffed her pistol back into the saddlebag and came out from behind her horse. Burley looked her up and down thoroughly, which prompted him to ask his next question.
You in some kind of trouble?
Lily was tempted to take advantage of the man's apparent charitable nature toward her, but a mental picture of Boot caused her to hesitate.
Someone is after me. Someone who is very dangerous and might kill anyone who helps me.
Blame me. Who'd want to... I mean, what'd you do?
I ran away.
Then, in childlike fashion, she poured out her story, although she had thought not to involve him. She told of Boot Stoner's sudden appearance at her adoptive parents' home and the horrors that followed.
You think he'll come after you?
Yes.
Well, young lady, maybe you was lucky I found you. I've been hiding out in these here mountains for a good many years and ain't nobody found me yet. You come on back to my cave. That devil ain't never gonna find you there. I've got food aplenty and you can rest up a while. Of course, I could have offered you some fresh venison if I hadn't run up on you.
I'm afraid Boot will find me, and it would be bad for you.
He ain't gonna find my place. Hell, I'll be lucky to find it again myself.
All right.
Good. You just get your horse and follow me. Well, now, it might be best if you lead him.
It was a trek of no more than 3 miles, but on foot it seemed a great deal longer. Crossing over the river, Burley said it was the buffalo, They made their way underneath steep cliffs of limestone before coming to an opening a little bigger than a crack. Lily would not have noticed it at all, since it was well disguised by a dense patch of wild holly. Burley cautioned her to follow directly in his footsteps, so as not to disturb the foliage. When she had led her horse through the opening, Burley went back and made sure the branches were not broken or leaning awkwardly to indicate someone had passed through them. Following the narrow game trail, they climbed for what seemed hours to Lily, causing her to marvel at her round little guide's stamina. Finally, they came to a waterfall high up on a mountain that fell 200 feet to a rocky stream below. There was a dingy gray horse tethered by the bank of the stream.
Welcome to my boat.
I don't see any camp.
My camp's inside, behind the waterfall. That's why nobody can't find it.
What about your horse? Anybody can see it.
I bring her in the cave at night, or when I think somebody might be close about. Wait, I'll show you.
Childlike in his eagerness to show off his primitive dwelling, Burley hurried up to the base of the waterfall.
See? Sadie'll let me know if anybody's coming.
Forgetting Boot Stoner for the moment, Lily could not suppress a smile as she followed the elfish little man as he stepped from rock to rock in the surging stream of clear water. When they reached the other side, she dropped her horse's reins, confident that it would be content to graze unfettered. Standing before the waterfall, Burley paused long enough to let Lily take a good look at it.
Ain't no way you can tell there's a cave behind that water unless you was to get right up against the cliff beside the fall. Well, that's the way I found it. Before that, I passed by this waterfall two or three times when I was riding with Bloody Jack Wheeler. I never seen it. I reckon you've heard of Bloody Jack's gang. No? I reckon you are mighty young to know about such things. Follow me.
Inside, just beyond the sheet of falling water, they entered a small cave about the size of a large room. Still, there were no signs of a camp there other than several piles of horse droppings. Burley went directly to a small opening at the back of the cave and, turning sideways, squeezed through. Lily, without the restrictions of Burley's generous stomach, passed through easily to find Burley waiting for her in a huge cavernous chamber perhaps three times larger than the outer cave. Here, in the dim light, she saw the evidence of more than 8 years' existence of the self-imposed hermit. Lily stopped to take it all in. His bedroll spread neatly against one wall, a fire pit near the back wall, various pots and pans stacked to one side of a wood pile. Next to the cooking utensils, there were several large parfleches, which she would later find to contain dried meat.
There's a natural smoke hole above the fire pit right through solid rock. The ceiling on this cave is a flat slab of rock laying across what I reckon was a gulch a long time ago. Now it's filled in around it with trees and stuff. The hole lets in a little light. If it weren't for that, you couldn't see a blame thing in here without a torch. Yeah, one time, about a year ago, a dead tree came down on the ridge above us, fell right smack across my smoke hole. I didn't even hear it fall, but pretty soon the cave started filling up with smoke till it plumb run me out. Me and Sadie had to go up on the ridge and move the blame tree. While I was at it, I drug another one over so's I had a log on both sides of the hole. Now a whole passel of trees could fall across it and they wouldn't stop up my smoke hole. But I'm just running off at the mouth. Let's see about fixing you up with something to eat. I reckon I've just been too blame long without somebody to talk to besides Sadie.
In short order, Burley stirred up the coals in the fire pit and had a fresh blaze going. He took several strips of dried venison and one chunk of smoked turkey from the parfleches and placed them in a pan to warm them.
Well, this'll do for now. Tonight we'll have us a stew. I'll catch us a squirrel or maybe a possum. Stew up a possum with some greens from the stream and some of them roots that look like turnips and you got yourself a fine supper. All the comforts of a home in the settlements. I do miss coffee, though. I make my own coffee. Make it out of acorns. Don't taste the same.
After the meal of dried meat, Lily tried a cup of Burley's acorn brew. It was much too bitter for her taste.
you have to get used to it, I reckon. You rest here while I take care of your horse. Then I'll be gone for a spell while I find something for supper. You can use my bedroll if you wanna.
It hit her then that she was near exhaustion. When Burley left the cave, she took a closer look at his bedroll. One look was enough to convince her that she would be more comfortable just curled up by the fire. John Ward stood staring down at the remains of a small campfire in a grove of poplars by the river. He extended one foot and poked around in the ashes with the toe of his boot. From all appearances, they'd not lingered long at this camp, judging by the amount of ashes. He looked around the little clearing again, somewhat puzzled by the two piles of items left behind. Some cooking utensils, clothing, tools, blankets, and other items, as well as the packs that had held them. Enough to furnish a household. Lying near the piles were two bridles. For some reason, Boot had decided to cut his pack mules loose. This notion was confirmed a short time later when John picked up their trail out of the camp. Tracks of the two horses alone led off toward the south. A short distance farther on, the tracks were joined by the tracks of the mules. John pictured the two mules tagging along behind Stoner and Lily, even though they had been freed. He followed the tracks for about 5 miles or so before finding another camp by a small stream. This was where they had stopped for the night. This was evident by the size of the fire and the disturbed leaves and grass where their bed had been. Horse droppings, the little bit of grass that had been grazed, broken branches, everything pointed to an overnight stay. It was getting late in the day. There would be little more than an hour left before darkness would force him to make camp. Boot had chosen a good campsite, and John hesitated over a decision to use it himself or push on for an hour or so before darkness stopped him. The buckskin seemed to be trying to influence him to stay. The horse sauntered over to the bank of the stream and began feeding upon the tender shoots at the water's edge.
All right, we'll make camp here.
While he made coffee, he considered the manner of man he trailed. Judging by the direction the outlaw had now turned, John had to speculate that Boot was gradually circling back toward the nations. He would know that for sure if Boot took a turn back toward the west before reaching the mountains. He felt confident that he was gaining on Boot. Each campsite he found told him so, but he was still not satisfied with his progress. It seemed that every day Boot was not caught provided the potential for another poor soul being murdered. He was already losing track of the number of days he had been on the half-breed's trail, arriving at the scene of one massacre after another, and always at least one day behind. He was beginning to try John's usual patience. While thinking about the man he chased, he also paused to puzzle over Lily. It was especially disturbing to him to recall the Joplin bartender's account of the shooting there. According to him, Lily had attacked the woman called Rose in a jealous rage over the woman's flirtatious attention to Boot. That didn't fit with the picture he had of Lily. The young Creek girl had been like a daughter to Wendell Stoner. It was hard to accept the fact that she might be a willing accomplice to Boot Stoner. During John's occasional visits to the trading post, Lily had always demonstrated affection to both Wendell and Morning Light. It just didn't seem right that the shy young girl would go bad and willingly ride with the likes of Boot Stoner. It was troubling, but he would be aware of the need to keep an eye on Lily when he caught up with Boot. These thoughts were heavy on his mind when he drifted off to sleep. As John awoke, the rain fairly soaked him before he could get his slicker from his saddlebags. He gathered his weapons and blanket in a losing effort to keep them dry. Crouching up under a low oak, he tried to fashion a tent with the slicker while the lightning flashed and the rain poured down in torrents. The storm had taken him totally by surprise, as storms this time of year had a habit of doing. There'd been no sign of an approaching storm the day before. It irritated him that he'd not seen it coming. Disgruntled, but knowing there was nothing to be done about it, he sat under the tree and waited for morning. With the arrival of first light, the storm had passed over, leaving broken tree limbs and leaves scattered about that spoke of the ferocity of the wind. The little stream had swollen to twice its original size. And most devastating of all was the absence of tracks. Boots' trail had been washed away by the storm. He spent some time searching the area where he had discovered the trail the night before in hopes that the rain had not erased every single track, but his search was in vain. Although he found some tracks, they were scattered, some horse, some mule, but none in a pattern that would signify a definite trail. Knowing only the general direction Boot had started out, he was left with no choice but to set out in the same direction and hope to pick up tracks farther on. Without taking time for coffee or breakfast, he saddled Cousin and, with a soggy blanket rolled up behind him, rode off through the trees toward the distant hills. After stopping just before noon, he was back in the saddle and on his way once more, riding blind, for there were no tracks to be found. It was difficult to believe that the storm had smoothed out every track, so he had to assume that Boot's trail was either to the east or west of him. Following the hunch that Boot would eventually cut back to the west and head for Indian territory, John decided to continue riding south and hope to pick up Boot's cross trail. Some 2 miles short of the rugged Boston Mountains, his hunch appeared to have borne fruit. Riding between two hills, he crossed over a trickle of a stream and paused to let Cousin drink. While he waited, his eye caught sight of a clearly defined hoof print in the sandy shoulder of the stream. He immediately dismounted to look for more. Looking closely at the print, he determined that it was from one of the mules. Evidently, they were still following Boot and Lily. The hoof print was pointing west, crossing his trail. Needing at least one more for confirmation, he walked carefully along the bank, his eyes searching the ground. Suddenly, there it was. A second print, also of a mule, and pointing west like the first. This seemed to be confirmation, but he stopped to debate it in his mind before committing. There was no print from a horse, and there were only 2 mule prints. He squinted his eyes and looked to the south, where there were no tracks. Then he considered his hunch that Boot was heading back to Indian territory. He decided to follow the tracks. He stepped up in the saddle and turned Cousin's head to the west. With no other tracks to follow, the only option was to follow a hunch.
Hell, I'd just be wasting time wandering around in those mountains looking for a trail.
Burley Chase knelt before the fire, tending a frying pan containing strips of fresh-killed venison, the meat courtesy of the doe he had hunted 2 days before.
She should have known I'd be back for her.
Lily had offered to cook the meat, but he insisted that she was his guest, and as such, it wouldn't be polite to let her do the cooking. After some solid food and 2 nights' sleep, she was at the point where she could put Boot Stoner out of her mind for long periods of the day. She felt safe for the first time in weeks, and Burley was obviously pleased to have her company. She studied the round little man's face as he knelt before the fire, and she couldn't picture him riding with a gang of bushwhackers. Bright blue eyes that seemed a contrast to the bushy dark eyebrows fairly sparkled with good humor when he talked about his days with Bloody Jack Wheeler. The thick gray bush that served as a beard bore traces of acorn coffee and was complemented by gray tufts of hair protruding from each nostril. It was a picture that fascinated the slender Creek girl. For his part, Burley was thoroughly enjoying the company. The Indian girl did not, in fact, talk a great deal, but Burley hardly noticed, as he was so busy carrying the conversation without her help. Her presence served to demonstrate to him just how lonely he had been for human company, and he found himself thinking about risking a trip back to find his wife and daughter. Maybe he might even offer to go back with Lily, but thoughts of Union patrols searching the countryside for outlaw bands like the one he had ridden with still caused him to hesitate. His existence was a lonely one, but certainly preferable to living out his years in a prison cell. Besides, he'd been a hermit for so long now that he wasn't sure he'd even be able to leave the security of his mountain cave. Maybe it was best that he didn't realize exactly how many years had passed since he had made his home here, and that Union patrols had long since given up looking for holdouts like Burley Chase. For the time being, he was content to enjoy Lily's company. It would be best for the girl to linger here a while, in case the crazy savage who was after her was in fact looking for her in these mountains. As each day passed, Lily gradually lost more and more of the fear that had driven her so desperately. Burley was a kind man, very much like Wendell Stoner had been, and she felt safe in the cave behind the waterfall. Thoughts of reaching her aunt and uncle in Lohawk were still present in her mind, but the urgency was no longer dominating her every moment. Burley was obviously happy to have her stay as long as she wanted.
It's a right nice evening. If you want to, we can take our supper outside by the waterfall. Might be nicer than sitting in this cave.
The suggestion appealed to Lily. They had eaten outside the night before, and it was a pleasant setting indeed. The cave felt safe and secure, and she was thankful for it at night. But she didn't like the feeling of being inside the ground during the day. Outside, the air was fresh and crisp. Spring in the mountains lagged behind the lower climates, but it was finally showing signs in the budding trees and bushes. Soon the foliage above the waterfall would be thick with leaves that would screen any animal from sight. On this early spring day, however, the trees had not filled in to that point, and if Burley or Lily had chanced to glance up toward the top of the waterfall, they might have noticed the solitary figure standing there. He stood motionless, watching for a long time. The beauty and tranquility of the setting escaped his twisted mind as he took time to gloat over having found her. The fury that had built up in him over the last several days was pacified by the prize of finally tracking her down. He gazed with contempt at the fat little man sitting cross-legged before her and eagerly awaited the pleasure to be derived from his slaughter. Boot had almost given up on his search for Lily, having lost her trail several times before stumbling onto it again. He had found her tracks at the creek when she had joined someone else, an occurrence that had infuriated him. But he lost their trail when they crossed the river. So for a day and a half after that, he had roamed the mountain, looking for some sign, until he decided it was useless to continue. And then he heard a single shot from a carbine on the far side of the mountain. He followed the sound and searched again until he found the spot where a deer had been killed. It was easy to follow the trail from there. And now, there they were, trapped in a box canyon with no escape. He could feel the adrenaline pumping in his veins as he anticipated the pleasure of the reunion. Lily finished her supper of fresh venison and took her plate to the edge of the stream to wash it. Bathed in the afterglow of the setting sun, she lingered there for a moment more to watch the last rays of sunlight filter through the mist at the base of the waterfall. Suddenly she felt a chill race along her spine as an owl passed directly over her. This was a bad sign, and she sensed something wrong. When she looked up to find the owl, her gaze drifted to the cliff high above her and the solitary figure standing there. Dismissing it as a shadow, she shifted her gaze again, looking for the owl, but her gaze was instantly drawn back to the figure. It was him. She rocked back on her heels. The plate, forgotten, dropped from her hand and drifted a few yards downstream before settling to the bottom. Unable to speak, she simply stared at the apparition for long moments, praying desperately that it was no more than that, a ghost, conjured in her mind, and would disappear as suddenly as it had come. Paralyzed by her fear, she could not move until Boot suddenly made a move, releasing her from the spell. Startled by the girl's sudden scream, Burley tried to scramble to his feet. A bullet caught Burley in the shoulder.
Run!
The two of them ran for the waterfall, just managing to disappear behind the cascading water. Puzzled by the flight to the waterfall by the pair below him, Boot stood waiting for a minute, expecting them to show on the other side of the water. When they did not, he figured there had to be a cave behind the fall. Although the thought served to irritate him, he was smug in the knowledge that they were still trapped. Keeping his eye on the waterfall, he led his horse as he began to work his way down the side of the cliff on foot. Inside the cave, Burley and Lily hurried past the horses in the outer chamber and through the narrow opening to the larger cave. His brain in confusion, Burley immediately grabbed his rifle and, with blood running down his arm, knelt down and trained it on the passage between the two chambers. Lily ran to him to try to tend to his wound.
Boot!
Was that the son of a bitch? He blame sure put a hole in my shoulder.
Fighting her emotions, Lily tried to stop Burley's bleeding.
Boot!
We're all right.
Boot!
He's got to come through that opening to get to us. And if he does, I'll pepper his ass good. Are you sure that's the man chasing you?
I saw him. He was standing at the top of the cliff just looking down at us.
Yeah, well, like I said, he's got to come through that crack to get at us, so we'll just wait and see what he does. We've got food and a little bit of water. We can hold out for a good spell, and from what you've told me, he ain't hardly the patient type. And don't worry about this wound. I'll be all right.
He managed to smile for her, then turned his full attention to the opening. Moving with the utmost caution, Boot Stoner worked his way down to a point next to the stream, where he paused to take a long look at the sheet of water dropping from the cliff he had just left. It was impossible to see any outline of a cave, if in fact there was one. He had to also allow for the possibility that there was nothing more than a hollow behind the fall, and that they might be waiting in ambush. Leaving his horse by the stream, he moved quickly to the other side and dropped to one knee, again waiting and listening. The light was fading fast, so he deemed it best to wait a few minutes more until darkness started to set in. He managed to wait for a while, but being a man who had never known patience, he started creeping toward the fall before a hard dark set in, his rifle ready to return fire. But there were no shots as he approached the wall of the cliff. He slowly edged along behind the curtain of crashing water until he came to the opening to the cave. Dropping immediately to the ground, he peered into the cave, searching for a target. Still, there were no shots to greet him. He lay there for a few moments, his eyes gradually adjusting to the darkness. As he stared, the moving objects slowly took shape, and he realized that they were horses. Beyond them, a faint light revealed a narrow opening in the back wall. Moving up beside the opening, he hesitated to expose himself long enough to look inside, so he took his hat off and placed it on the end of his rifle barrel. Staying close to the wall, he held the hat out in front of the opening. It was immediately knocked off the rifle with a bullet hole through the crown, just as he expected.
Lily! Come out of there, and I won't hurt the old man!
Tell you what, why don't you just come on in?
Lily! If you don't come on out, I'll kill the old man. If you come on out now, I won't hurt you. But if you don't, I'll make you wish you never was born!
You can go to hell! He ain't coming out!
Burning with rage over the apparent impasse, Boot took a few steps away from the wall, enough to give him an angle to shoot through the opening without exposing himself. Boot's shots sent Lily's and Burly's terrified horses racing out of the cave.
It's the last chance I've given you! Come on out of there!
All was silent in the cave. Seconds ticked away. Boot knelt, glaring at the narrow opening, his frustration growing with each moment. Still, there was no sound from inside the cave.
I'm gonna hit one of them. Maybe both of them. Or they might just be playing possum, hoping I come through that opening.
The more he thought about it, the bigger the likelihood seemed that they wanted him to come in. He had to admit that they were at an impasse. They couldn't come out, and he couldn't go in after them. Then another thought occurred to him, one he'd forgotten about.
I got just the thing to take care of them, too.
Running back to his horse, he reached into his saddlebags and retrieved the two sticks of dynamite he had taken from Fannin's store. Hurrying to return to the cave, he quickly crawled up beside the opening. He placed the sticks near the foot of the narrow entrance. Giving the explosives plenty of room, he passed behind the sheet of falling water and ran toward his horse. Boot stood transfixed for a long moment, in awe of the magnitude of the explosion. Then, delighted with the apparent results, he made his way back into the cave, holding his bandana over his mouth and nose as he moved through the thick black haze. Reaching the back wall of the outer chamber, however, he found that instead of blowing a hole in it, the dynamite had caused the dividing wall to collapse, effectively sealing off the entrance completely.
Damn!
Taking out his knife, he made a few futile stabs at the wall of dirt and rocks in a desperate attempt to dig a hole through. He soon realized that it was impossible, and his anger threatened to choke him.
All right.
I can't get in, but by God, they can't get out.
I told you to come out of there, you coyote bitch! Now you're in the ground for good! I bet you wish you was with old Boat now, huh?
Inside the earthen tomb, Lily crawled on hands and knees, trying her best not to breathe in the thick, dirty air that filled the chamber. Her concern was for Burly. The round little man had not called to her after the explosion, and the air was so thick with dirt and smoke she could no longer see him. Making her way across the littered floor of the cave, she found him. Half his body was buried under a massive mound of dirt and rock, and his eyes stared unseeing into hers. She at once recoiled in horror, then reached out to touch him. There was no response, only the cold, sightless stare. Her confusion lasted for only a short while before her will to survive returned to calm her. Her one chance for escape came to her then, the smoke hole. In frantic eagerness, she crawled over to the fire, still glowing with dying coals. Looking up to the top of the cave, she could just barely make out the small opening some 20 feet above her. From the floor of the cave, she found it hard to judge if she could squeeze her body through it. The problem was secondary to the question of whether or not she could climb up the back wall of the cave to reach the hole. She gathered the few things she could carry for her survival, knowing that if she reached the hole, she was not coming back down. She bundled them up in one of Burly's shirts and tied them with a rope. The free end she tied around her ankle and prepared to ascend the wall. There was little effort required to reach the stone ledge about 6 feet above the fire pit. After that, there was a long expanse before reaching a narrow, rocky shelf. Standing on the ledge, she went to work with her knife, carving out hand and footholds. It was not easy, and she almost decided it was impossible. But when she thought of the alternative, she forced herself upward, inch by painful inch. She was climbing in almost total darkness, feeling her way up the wall, holding on with one hand while digging hand and toeholds with the other. Straining to get both feet on the shelf, she felt her strength draining away, and a new feeling of panic began to overcome her. She thought that if she could just get her feet up under her, she could rest for a moment. This was when she felt a faint whisper of fresh air upon her face. It was enough to encourage her to continue climbing, for she knew she was getting close to the opening. Reaching deep inside her frail body for strength, she pushed upward, digging each handhold, until finally she reached up and felt the edge of the opening. Flushed with the excitement of reaching the hole, she pushed her body up high enough to clear it with her head. A new sense of panic struck her. The hole was not big enough to get her shoulders through. The edges of the hole were solid rock, and she remembered then that Burly had explained that the flat ceiling of his cave was a rock slab. Feeling her self-control slipping away, she looked down at the tiny glow of the fire some 20 feet below her. She had a sudden impulse to simply let go. Then she fought back against the feeling of doom, telling herself that she would not die in this cave. With a new determination, she crouched low enough to pull her head back down. Then she extended her free hand up through the hole, and with her chin tucked tightly against her breast, thrust upward with her legs as hard as she could. Her body was wedged into the narrow opening, seemingly stuck. Though awkward and painful, she laboriously forced her foot up to the next foothold, jamming her body even tighter into the unforgiving passage. Once again, she strained against the opening, her shoulder throbbing with pain and threatening to break. There was no use. She could not make herself any smaller. Now, effectively stuck, unable to go up or down, she feared this was going to be the place of her death. Resigned to her inevitable ending, she felt her pounding heart slowly settle into a normal rhythm. As soon as she exhaled, she felt her body slip a fraction of an inch. Reacting instantly, she pushed up with her legs, mustering all the strength she could, and suddenly her hand grasped a limb. She remembered then that Burly had dragged a couple of logs over on each side of the opening. With a good firm hold on the limb, she pulled herself up until she felt the skin being scraped from her trailing arm as her shoulder moved upward. Suddenly her shoulder was free, and she pulled her arm up until it was out of the opening. And she was now free from the waist up. Her heart pounding again, this time from joyous excitement, she placed her hands on both sides of the hole and drew her lower body up. When at last she swung her feet over the top of the hole, she pulled her possessions up and then lay exhausted beside the log on one side of Burley's smoke hole. She did not rest there long. Thoughts of the unfortunate little man buried beneath the rubble below caused her a few moments of grief before the brooding image of Boot Stoner descended upon her mind. As if to remind her of her peril, a bright three-quarter moon stared down at her like an unblinking eye in the dark heavens above the trees. On her knees at once, she peered over the log to see where she had emerged. As best she could determine, she was about halfway up the slope, rising to the top of the waterfall. Looking all around her, there was no sign of anything but the dark trees and underbrush, but she still felt an urge to run before Boot suddenly appeared. With her few belongings and Boot's pistol, she started making her way down the mountain. On foot now, and not certain if she was even fleeing in the right direction, she set her determination on Lohawk in the Creek Nation.